Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, The Weekend Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. My guest today is an author, Connie Nordholm Wooldridge. She has just published her latest book, Just Fine, The Way They Were. Connie, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Simon. It's great to be here. And by the way, the title is Just Fine, The Way They Are. Ongoing.
Oh, The Way They Are. I do apologize. That is absolutely my mistake. I was confused when we were setting this interview up. I know that you're in Indiana, and yet you were saying that it was Eastern Standard Time. And I looked it up, and apparently Indiana is one of those few states that does actually straddle time zones.
Yeah, we do, Simon. We actually, up until about 2 or 3 years ago, we were a little schizophrenic. We were on East Coast time for part of the year and Central time for the other part of the year, and people that were trying to get a hold of me from far away would always be confused and want to know which time period we were in. Finally, most of the state voted to go with Eastern Standard and Eastern Daylight Savings Time. The only holdouts being those people near Chicago, and I think there are also a few near Evansville in that area that stick with Central Time. So it's a little confusing, but we deal with it.
Too confusing for me. Okay, I'd like to start with a little biographical information. Who is Connie Nordholm Wooldridge?
Well, Connie Nordholm was born in Black Mountain, North Carolina in 1950. I've moved around an awful lot in my lifetime. I've lived in North Carolina, and then my family moved up in the Cleveland area where I lived until I was in ninth grade, and then my family moved to Massachusetts where I went to high school and college. After I graduated from high school, I went to Mount Holyoke College, did my junior year in Athens, Greece. At the time, I thought I was going to be an archaeologist or a classicist or something of the sort. But I came home and wound up as a stewardess for American Airlines, flight attendant, I think it's called now, which I did for a year. And then I flew over to Seoul, South Korea, where I worked as a first grade teacher in an English-speaking school for 2 years. Came back, got my master's degree in library science and education from the University of Chicago. And it was right at that juncture that I would say my writing career began, because I got exposed to children's books at the University of Chicago and began to review children's books for School Library Journal. Served on the Newbery-Caldecott Committee, which awards the most distinguished books each year, and started thinking I might be able to write one of those things. So that's sort of where the writing part of my life began.
Just Fine, The Way We Are is a wonderful, wonderful children's book, and it teaches the reader. Actually, it probably teaches a few adults as well.
Yes, I'm glad to hear that.
A very important yet overlooked part of our modern history. Would you like to tell us the subject matter?
Well, I write nonfiction for children. That's my love, and I take great joy in being able to take sometimes a very complicated subject and distill it down into a picture book format, which is 32 pages and a very spare amount of text. The way I like to do that is to do a lot of reading, a lot of research, and then focus in on the heart of the story. So I would say that Just Fine the Way They Are is a historical run through 200 years of history, starting in about 1800, and it focuses on transportation and specifically on the National Road. But there's an emotional component to the book, and it's never just the facts that make a story. You have to have some emotion in there. And I'm going to say that this book is a little autobiographical in a veiled, hidden sort of a way, because my history with technology is a series of grumpy junctures where I kept saying, things are just fine the way they are. Why can't I use my typewriter? And again, things are just fine the way they are. Why can't I continue to use my word processor? And when my husband finally bought me a computer, I again thought things are just fine the way they are and spent 2 months on this computer doing nothing but playing solitaire because I couldn't figure out anything else to do with it. So that emotion, that feeling we all have at some time in our lives or many times in our lives, that things are just fine the way they are, why do we have to change? That, I would say, is the passion behind the book, and just my little skirmishes with technology enabled me to sympathize with the characters in the book who thought the roads were just fine, who thought wagons were just fine. Why did we have to move on to trains? And so on and so on and so on. It's emotion that everyone can share. And then it really makes the point at the end of the story when the challenge comes down, are things just fine the way they are right now?
That is a very deep, deep question. I think it's a subject that young minds should understand. The road and rail system forever changed society. Just Fine the Way We Are reminded me of a little story from my youth. I grew up in England, although you'd never guess it from my accent.
Uh-huh.
My parents owned a pub in rural Oxfordshire. England is the size of a postage stamp, and we lived right in the middle of it. This meant that it was a whopping 60 miles to the coast. Yet many people in this small farming community had never seen the ocean. They were born in the village, they worked in the village, and they died in the village. Modern transportation changed all that. Would you not agree? Now, obviously, the U.S. is far different from the U.K., but it's the same idea, I think.
Right. And that is a fascinating observation about the way transportation changes things. Actually, the thing I was more curious about and that I bumped into early on, and I did before Just Fine the Way They Are came out, back in, I'm trying to think, it was about 2004 or so, I did an article for Cricket Magazine, another one about the National Road, and the thing that really struck me there was the difference between the way Americans view movement and the way Europeans view movement. Americans are moving all the time. They're not satisfied unless they're moving. They're moving physically. There's a social component to the movement. They move up the social ladder and down the social ladder, or they did for sure in the early years of our country. Being confined is something that really aggravates them in a big way. You just always have this sense of of Americans leaving for the West, and there's this bittersweet feeling there. And I think that the way transportation changed things in say, the country that you say is as small as a postage stamp would be very different from the way transportation changed things here in the United States, simply because of the size of the country and the expanses. It changed people's mental thinking about movement and transportation and how far exactly you could go. So it's a wonderful question. The article that I wrote for Cricket begins this way: the Americans of the early 1800s loved to move. They moved out, moved on, and moved up in life. They also loved the things that helped them move. And it goes on and talks about an incident where actually the bad repairs on the National Road kept them from moving. And the story talks about a small town in Plainfield, Indiana, that caused President Martin Van Buren to be dumped out into the mud when he came to visit their town because they were so irate with him for not fixing the National Road. So there is a lot to this subject of movement and transportation. There's a physical component to it and a sort of a psychological component as well.
Many people misconstrue what the National Road was. But would you like to put the put the story straight? What was the National Road? I mean, it didn't run across country, I don't think.
No. At its longest point, it was about 600 miles long. It stretched from Cumberland, Maryland, to Vandalia, Illinois. But its claim to fame is it was the first federally funded road in the United States. And if you can imagine back at that time when the states were pretty well territorial about their rights, trying to first figure out where this road would go, and the southern states considered it not a national road but a northern road because it didn't go through their particular states. And then the idea of how to handle this funding of this road, and then once the road was built, who would fund the repairs? So there were it was a big thing to conceive of, and it caused some trouble in its building, and it really never was complete from one end to the other until we get to the modern era. So it was a very big deal back in its day.
What age group are you aiming the book at?
I would say upper elementary, which would be 8, 9, 10, 11. And I have even had junior high school teachers tell me that this is a great book to use in social studies because they can use it to summarize an era or a lesson or something like that. You know, Simon, it used to be that picture books were aimed at very young readers. When you thought picture book, you thought of a 3-year-old, 4-year-old sitting on your lap. But picture books have really grown up, especially nonfiction picture books, and have become great vehicles for communicating some pretty complicated concepts through words and pictures. And of course, picture books by nature can be read over and over and over again. So you kind of get to solidify the concepts and talk about them, and they're a great medium as far as I'm concerned.
They are indeed. I'm a huge fan of picture books, believe it or not. I read way too many books every year, but I love picture books. And when they are done well, they are done so well. They're often short in text, but very rich in information if you have the right illustrator, which, of course, I have to talk about Richard Waltz. He has done a fabulous job
Absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about him.
Okay. Well, you'll be surprised to know that I have never met or talked to Richard Waltz, and that is true. I've done 5 picture books now. That was true of each one of my picture books, the illustrators for each one of my picture books. After the book came out, I met certain of those illustrators, and I have had a roundabout email correspondence with Rick Waltz. I always tell, when I go to do school talks, I tell students that the relationship between an author and an illustrator of a picture book is sort of that of an arranged marriage. I submit my manuscript to an editor, and the first thing that editor will do is go to his or her stable of illustrators and pick one that will work for my exact manuscript. I've done 5 books. 2 of them were done by the same illustrator, but the other 3 are different illustrators, and that has to do with the character of the manuscript, whether it's a folk tale, nonfiction, the age level, the expertise of the illustrator. And I absolutely agree with you. Rick Waltz was a perfect choice for this book. His research was meticulous, and he has an amazing sense of humor as well. I don't know if you've had a chance to comb through the book, but at the very beginning on the title page, there's an exit sign, and if you look closely, it says Skunk Haven. On the exit sign, there's an illustration when the wheelmen come in and they're causing all kinds of trouble. There are these 2 wonderful sheep in the corner of the illustration who are just looking bewildered. They have very human faces. He just does a wonderful job of getting in the humor. And then there's that dark 2-page spread toward the end of the book with the oil wells where the text is talking about the fact that we're maybe dirtying up the air with all our cars and all of that, and he does a wonderful job of changing tone there. He also told me, and I didn't know this until after the book came out, that there's a car on the dedication page and on the title page with a family, and he says that he went on my website and read some of my blogs and tried to make that as much like I described myself in a car back in the 1950s as he could. I'd like to read the dedication if I could. Would that be all right?
Certainly.
Sure. It says, "To my dad, Bernd Nordhelm, who drove a Chevy along the roads of Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, with my mom riding shotgun and me in the back seat, car sick." And when Rick did the illustration, he said he did not make me car sick, so I appreciated that.
Actually, I think it's the cover art that this appears on. There's a really interesting aspect. You have the freeway, and there's a small sign that says 70. And there's a road next to it with another speed sign that says 40. Mm-hmm. I just thought that was simply a fabulous detail to add.
It is wonderful. It's as if you have all the different modes of transportation right there on the cover. It reminds me a little bit of an Escher painting. You kind of don't know where you are. The other place where that happens is on the very last 2-page spread, where you have the sort of a futuristic man, and then there's sort of a parade going back in the distance, and you see each of the modes of transportation there, and going way back. And if you look, you can just see one lone human being running as hard as he can to catch up with the wagon that's right in front of him. So I think that's illustrators do far more than just draw pictures of the words I write. They literally tell the story themselves, and Richard Waltz has done a wonderful job interpreting my words researching to get the details right, but he does a lot of the storytelling himself. He as you pointed out, shows these various modes of transportation all together on the cover, and just does a wonderful job of portraying the panoramic nature of this whole subject. I couldn't have been more pleased with his work. Couldn't have been more pleased.
I'm still somewhat in shock that you and he did not, you know, work more closely. In some ways, it's wonderful, you know, that he could take your words and turn them into pictures. But I'm still surprised that, you know, you weren't, you know, in a huddle, you know,
right,
for weeks. You know,
that does surprise people. Well, let me describe it to you this way. First of all, I did see and do see along the way rough sketches, and that is so just basically so that I can check on historical details. And if I see something that looks off, that looks anachronistic or something, I can jump in at that point. But if you picture a creative person sitting down to draw, and then if you picture me, the writer, sitting right beside him, and he starts to draw, and I say, oh no, I didn't picture it that way. No, I did. I wanted the children taller. I wanted them to look like this. I wanted them to look like that. That would be a very antagonistic relationship very, very quickly. And I think possibly editors found that out early on, that you really have to give the illustrator a chance to go ahead and do his or her thing. I think that the reason the picture book medium works so well for me is because I tend to be a totally non-visual person. I'm very verbal. I hear the story in my head, but people are always asking me, do you see the pictures? Are you upset when you get the pictures because they're not what you had in mind? I really am not visual at all, and I don't tend to go on and on in my picture books describing things, which illustrators absolutely hate. If you go on for, you know, the person was this tall and brown hair and blue eyes, wore glasses, it just really confines them. So what I try to do is just make sure that I get the facts right first, the emotions down pat, so that the grumpiness of John Slack, for example. I didn't say anything about how he looked, but I described at the beginning that he was really irate, things are just fine the way they are, and a good road is bad for business, and that's that. And that's what I wanted to communicate, and then I want to let Rick Waltz take it from there, put clothes on John Slack, decide how tall he is, and all those other details.
Well, you know, I'm still in shock, but, you know, nevertheless, I'm hugely impressed by the work that Rich Waltz did. I mean, just fabulous, fabulous illustrator. And the trick with a picture book, and it's an unfortunate name for it because, you know, people automatically assume, you know, you're aimed at the preschooler, you know, population. But your illustrator has to meet the age requirements, if you will, of the reader. It's easy to mess it up. You know, you can produce a book aimed at a preschooler and have illustrations that are too old, and vice versa. You can have a book aimed at an older age group and produce illustrations that do not appeal to that age group. And just a fabulous job.
Yes, yes, he did. And I think, you know, when I think you've expressed this a little bit, when I talk to adults, they love to read this book. I mean, they read it to their students or to their children, but they get a lot out of this book. So obviously, Rick's illustrations appeal to them, and then you also have enough of the lighthearted, younger images in the illustrations to draw in those of a younger audience. Now, obviously, there are limitations. You can't appeal to a three-year-old and a teenager. That's probably not going to work in one book, but I would say he stretched it to the limit here. He certainly did.
As I understand it, in fact, you already mentioned it, this isn't your first foray into the book world. What else do you have floating out there?
Okay. Well, you can check them out on my website, which is conniewooldridge.com, but I'll tell you a little bit about them. My first book came out in 1995. It's called Wicked Jack, and this is a perfect month for me to be telling you about it because it's a folk tale, retelling of a folk tale, and it's the story behind jack-o'-lanterns. So it's a perfect book to get out in this month. Then two more books came out in 2000. One was called When Esther Morris Headed West, and the subtitle is Women, Wyoming, and the Right to Vote. And again, it was a very large subject captured in a 32-page picture book about a woman named Esther Morris, who was the first female judge of the United States, out in the Wyoming Territory. And I did not know this before I started research on the book, but the Wyoming Territory was the first place in the United States to grant women the right to vote before it even was a state. And actually, the state was very concerned when the territory was very concerned when they made a bid for statehood that the United States would not let them in with this women's suffrage clause in their constitution. It's a delightful story, and again, I direct you to my website. You can see the cover of the book and hear a little bit about it. Another folk tale came out that same year called The Legend of Strap Buckner, and this is a Texas folk tale about a big strapping guy, sort of part of Texas history, but grows larger than his image. And then in 2005, a book called Thank You Very Much, Captain Erickson came out, and this tells the story of the inventor of the monitor that fought the Merrimack in the Civil War, the two ironclads that fought to a draw at Hampton Roads.
What a great subject.
It was. And actually, it focuses on the inventor himself, who was a man beyond his time and happens to be a distant relative of mine. So the way that book came about is my son, when he was in sixth grade, he's now 30, when he was in sixth grade, had to do a report for school. And, of course, I was encouraging him to do something easy like George Washington or something like that, and he wanted to do a report on this ancestor he'd heard about of ours called John Erickson, and that's how I started getting interested in the subject. I tried to help him with his research, and it led to a picture book years later. So, and then in 2010, just a year ago, I tried something completely different. I thought I'd try a biography for older readers, junior high and high school, and I wrote a book about the American author Edith Wharton, and it's called The Brave Escape of Edith Wharton, and that made me a little bit nervous because the editor for most of my picture books wasn't interested because it just wasn't a subject they wanted to take on. So it was almost as if I had to go back to the drawing board and begin submitting this manuscript to editors I didn't know. But it was well received and got a review in the New York Times and really has done well. So I'm pretty proud of that book as well.
That's not too shabby. I understand it, you've also created some additional material to help educators and parents use Just Fine.
Right. And this I'm so excited about, because I think even though I only taught for a very short time, 2 years, my heart has always been in the classroom. And as I write these nonfiction books, part of me is always thinking, how can I let teachers know that these are here and how to use them in their classroom? So that's always been in the back of my mind. And this amazing thing hit the scene called the Internet, and I realized recently that it might be a great vehicle for creating some lesson plans and making those available in the classroom. But I have to tell you that my Just Fine the Way They Are mentality kicked in for a long time, and I didn't even have a website up and running until actually January of this past year. So when I finally got that website up and running, it was about the time Just Fine the Way They Are came out, and I sent out a card to my friends, which I'd like to read you the message on. It says, "Real writers don't need razzle-dazzle websites. It's good writing that sells books, not razzle-dazzle websites. Who needs razzle-dazzle websites? Things are just fine the way they are. P.S. Check out my new razzle-dazzle website." So kind of making fun of myself. But anyway, this website and the Internet just provided a wonderful platform for me to get together with some local educators. They are both teachers, one a sixth grade teacher, one teaches first grade, and they also are adjunct professors at Earlham College, which is here in Richmond. So they teach, and they teach teachers, and they put together some lesson plans for me that are just astounding. There are three sets to date. We're working on a fourth one. One centers on comprehension. The second one centers on social studies and transportation. And the third one centers on the writer's craft. And if you go on my website, you can see those lesson plans. You can copy worksheets. The whole thing is there, and they've done a great job of organizing the thing, starting with an essential question for each lesson, big ideas, materials and resources you'll need, vocabulary words. They have large group suggestions, small group suggestions, suggestions for teachers who just like a small nudge and then like to run with it. There's part of the lesson plans are geared toward teachers that like step-by-step lesson plans. They are just invaluable. I did a presentation over the weekend at to some Muskingum University students in Ohio, and they were just floored by these, by what's available. And not only can you use these lesson plans for this particular book, Just Fine the Way They Are, but they can serve as a template for other books. You can use this structure and begin to put together a lesson plan for some other nonfiction books that you might want to use in the classroom. So I am tremendously excited about this and want to get the word out about them. So thank you for bringing them up.
What kind of reception and feedback are you getting from Just Fine?
Well, good reviews in the print media, Kirkus, Booklist. It was reviewed in the Los Angeles Times, which amazingly focused on the environmental aspect, which comes up at the very end of the book. It was included on a list of books that for environmental books for children. But just, again, just recently, I decided I wanted to try to push the reviews on websites and blogs, things like that. And I really have hit that hard, and it's amazing. Once you get known or somebody talks about your book, it goes viral, as my children tell me, and that's good. That's good. My children tell me that's good. So this has been a new experience for me, getting online and finding out each day practically that another blogger has picked up on the book and has something to say about it. And I would say that for the most part, the response has been wonderful. They and I guess I should have expected this, surprising, because I think people are surprised at finding a picture book that is informational and fun at the same time. That seems to be the thing people are picking up on here. They're just surprised at that and wanting to tell people about it.
Oh, indeed. And as I said, one of my favorite genres to work with is children's books. I think you've done a fabulous job.
Well, I really appreciate your support, Simon, because I it just is always nice when I feel as if you're someone who has seen a lot of picture books, but maybe not this particular type of picture book, a pretty heavy-duty informational one. So I so appreciate your comments.
Many authors that I talk to are engaging in their first trip to the rodeo and learning the three phases to the whole book world, and each one gets progressively more difficult and frustrating. Writing the book is actually quite hard work, and it takes a huge amount of time. Publishing the book is often so frustrating that disemboweling yourself with a plastic butter knife sounds, it sounds preferable. And then comes the dreaded M word, marketing. What are your thoughts on this? Are you doing book signings, readings?
Okay, I think I'm glad you brought that up, because when I talk to writers, what I tell them is you have to have really three hats, and they're the three things that you just described. When you're doing the writing part, you're tapping into your creative side, and usually you're very vulnerable. It's your baby, and criticism is not what you need at that particular time, except from somebody that you trust, that you know is going to be gentle with you. So you just have to let those creative things happen at that point and try to protect yourself, basically. I always tell people that the most vulnerable time is right when you finish a story, because it's at that point that you think it's absolutely terrific and you want to run and show it to someone, read it to your husband, read it to your children, read it, and you usually get a bad reaction, and it can be devastating. So I always caution people to just, when they finish writing, don't run and read it to someone right away. Just sit there with it, kind of bond with your story, start to believe in it, just take that time. Then when you move into the publishing phase, you have to turn into a vacuum cleaner salesman. That's what your story is. It's a vacuum cleaner. And when a publisher says, "I'm sorry, we don't want your story," they're saying, "I don't need this vacuum cleaner right now." And you go to the next door and you knock on that door. So you really have to put on a thick skin at that point and almost disassociate yourself from the story. Those two parts of the process I have always been very comfortable with for some reason. It's not that I like rejection so much, but I think I knew early on about that bonding time with the story, and I usually believe wholeheartedly in my stories and believe that the people that are rejecting them are somehow not very bright. I can move myself into that mode and just keep going. The marketing part of things has always been difficult for me until I kind of got this website and got hooked up on the internet. I do go and do school talks. I get invited to speak, and authors do things like called book fairs, where you go and sit at a table with a stack of your books, and a lot of other authors are there, things like that. But those kinds of things take so much time away from my desk, And it's not that I don't like doing them, but the time away can be hard because it's an interruption. I really am enjoying the kind of marketing that has been opened up through the internet, which is things like hooking up with bloggers and I post reviews on Amazon for other people, and they review on Amazon for me. It's kind of a wonderful thing that has opened up. So that third phase was the one I always had trouble with, and I have to say I'm doing better with it now that I've plugged into the internet here.
You're a wired author.
Right.
Your publisher, I think, is Calkins Creek. That's not a publisher I'm very familiar with. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Sure. You are more familiar with them than you think. They are a division of a publisher called Boys Mills Press, and Boys Mills Press is the book publishing arm of a very well-known magazine called Highlights for Children. So when I first started writing, I got articles accepted by Highlights for Children, and when they started doing books, and it's been years now, they were a publisher that I always kept in mind because I had this relationship with their magazine. So I think people always associate Highlights for Children. I always saw it in the dentist's office, and it's a very old, venerable children's magazine. It's been around for years and years, and it's a family-run magazine, and the book arm of it is also. So it's a real joy to work with those people. The first four picture books I did were published by Holiday House, which is a children's-only publisher in New York, and then the biography I did of Edith Wharton was published by Clarion Houghton Mifflin, which is another New York company. So again, I think the publishers have personalities, and you have to find the one that's a good match for your manuscript, and it takes some time to learn how to do that.
Oh, I think that is probably the understatement of the of the decade or the century. Find the right publisher, you'll be happy.
Mm-hmm.
Find the wrong publisher, you'll be reaching for that plastic butter knife.
Right. I think what's happened to publishers, people often see them as the bad guy. You send your manuscript and they reject it. That's the relationship. But I know for a fact that publishers are always looking for the next Harry Potter. They're frantic to find a great manuscript. And what's happened with computers is it's almost too easy to print out a manuscript or 100 manuscripts and send it out to 100 publishers without taking the time to check and make sure that publisher might be appropriate. So what happens is the editors end up with too many manuscripts that are inappropriate, and it makes them a little grumpy, and it makes it hard for those people who really do the research and take the time to try and find a good match for their manuscript. So I would just encourage writers out there to take that time. Go to the library and find a book that looks like the book you want yours to look like, and check and see what that publisher is, and it'll give you an idea what's out there.
Right. In fact, that's pretty much the advice I give to authors. You know, do your research. You know, you're fed up with the rejection letters. Maybe you're looking for love in all the wrong places.
That's a great way of putting it. And you can imagine how a publisher feels if they if they publish mostly mystery stories and they get a cookbook on their desk. I mean, it's very annoying. And it puts them in a bad mood for the rest of us. So we need to hit this pretty hard here.
Right. But there's one last topic that I want to touch on, but I have a feeling that it's a subject that might go on for hours. It's completely off topic, but I specialize in these. You were a teacher and a librarian, so I just can't resist. I feel that our education system is extremely broken at the moment. Do you share that view?
Well, I do, and I'm volunteering locally for a group called Communities and Schools, and also for another organization called Every Child Can Read that is focused on actually the third grade level and trying to create opportunities for third graders who aren't reading at grade level to pick up over the summer before they hit fourth grade. I think there are an awful lot of things going on. I think there's a lot of times the family situation has broken down, and when the teachers finally get the kids in the classroom, they either haven't had breakfast or they have family problems that are so severe they can hardly be expected to concentrate. But I'm not as hopeless, I think, as most people are. When I worked this past summer, this Every Child Can Read board created what we called a third grade academy, and we took the it was about 100 kids that had not passed our local Indiana reading test, and we created a 4-week summer camp, and we had the children in groups of 10 with one teacher and one assistant. We housed them in various wonderful places throughout our city, the art museum, the history museum, the library. Turned the teachers loose, basically, to create a reading environment for the day, but in a context that would keep the kids engaged. And they got to choose whether they wanted to do this camp at the art museum or the history museum or whatever. So I was amazed when the kids did their final projects at the various places, and I visited the art museum to go see what the kids had done over there. And every single parent showed up to see his or her child's work at this exhibit. These are not the parents I expected to find. I expected to find, you know, people sitting at home not caring. That was not who these people were. They are people who are working hard trying to make ends meet. They've got time pressures, financial pressures, and they love their kids and they're trying. And I think it just really encouraged me to see that and to see how hard the kids will work when they sense that you're paying attention to them, that you care. And part of the reason for this program was to not have X percentage of children who didn't pass the I-STEP, but Susie so-and-so or Johnny so-and-so. Every child had a name, and a teacher had spoken to us and told them what they thought was the problem. It was very well done, and it made me very, very hopeful. So things are afoot, Simon. I'm hoping that we'll maybe start the ball rolling in a better direction.
You know, I am a firm believer that the three R's are very important. But in some ways, the soft skills are just as important. The social skills are vital. And that's what I'm not seeing. Right now, the impetus seems to be to just pass, you know, standard tests and never mind, you know, any social skills. This bothers me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying, and I think this, the idea of teaching to the test, and I think teachers are a little bit crazy with it. We have the ability to measure down to a finite level the progress that has been made, but it almost turns the whole teaching process so clinical that you lose that the side of it that you're talking about, just that joy of being in the classroom, the joy of a teacher just standing up and coming up with a great way of communicating a concept. I think teachers are feeling that. I was really surprised. These lesson plans that I told you about, they were nothing like the lesson plans I did when I taught first grade in the mid-70s. I had a very open-ended, you know, I had a goal. I knew what I wanted to accomplish. I would come up with something that would help the kids learn that. Now, I can just tell by looking at these lesson plans, teachers are required to think, I'm going to say, on a more clinical level. That's the only way I can put it. And I think that's good in a way, but I think it winds up doing what you're talking about. It takes away that, I don't know, spontaneous, social, creative aspect to the teaching and the learning process.
Well, I'm a firm believer that education is about teaching people how to learn, how the enjoyment of learning. And I'm not sure that the teaching to meet standards is the way to go.
Mm-hmm. And I think there are many people who would agree with you. I'm not so involved in the educational process at this point that I can speak very intelligently to this issue. It's just a vague notion in my mind about a vague unease about the way things are going, and a vague hope that when I hear what you're saying and what some teachers are saying, that someone might take notice and move the thing in a better direction.
Connie, I'm looking at the clock. We've had a wonderful time. Is there any last parting comments you might have? Something I missed?
No, but if I have some upcoming events, I'll be in Cincinnati at an event called Books by the Banks on October 22nd. On November 5th, I'll be at Thomas More College in Kentucky for the Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana Children's Literature Conference. And on December 3rd, I'll be at the Holiday Author Fair in Indianapolis, and you can find details on those on my website. So,
okay, I told you a lie. I do have one last question.
Okay.
What is your next project? I'm sure you have one.
Well, I do, but I can't divulge it on the air because it's at the very beginning stages, and if you talk about something too soon, you lose it. I will tell you that it's a nonfiction project, probably a longer book, more like my Edith Wharton biography. It is not a biography, and it was suggested to me by the editor who did Edith Wharton. So I'm nosing around there, but can't give you the details right now. Just too early.
All right. Well, if you decide that project doesn't work, the book I would love to see would be one about Edison, Westinghouse, and who's the third guy? I can't remember.
Well, those are fascinating topics. I think
Tesla.
Tesla, T-E-S-L-A.
Yeah.
The car. Okay, and that would be amazing. All right, Simon, I will write those topics down, and if I come up with a book, you will be the first to know.
I just genuinely think it would turn into a wonderful picture book. The three of them had very different ideas, although Tesla and Westinghouse tended to be friends as opposed to Edison.
A little difficult to be a friend there, huh?
Right. I just think it would make for a wonderful, wonderful book.
Uh-huh. Are you talking about a book with all three of them in the book?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, their stories are so entwined.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, that's an interesting concept. That's an interesting concept.
Okay. Connie, I really want to thank you for taking time to talk to me and our listeners today. And I'm sure I speak for everyone in wishing you every success with your latest book and every success in your future endeavors.
Well, thank you, Simon. It was great talking to you today.
This is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy, healthy, and safe day. I'll be back again soon with another in our series, The Week in Reviews. Till then, goodbye.